welcome to Chewing the Cud, Season 2, Episode 3. My name's Andrew Jones, and unlike usual when I'm joined by Neil Gregor, today we have our guest host, and our guest host is previous guest Sarah Bolt. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, thank you so much for having me, Andrew.
No, thank you very much for stepping in at what is pretty much the last minute. I think it was about last week I rang you, wasn't it?
It was.
Unfortunately, Neil, I know this is in the diary, but obviously has other commitments that suddenly popped up, so Neil's currently overseas as we speak. So Sarah thankfully said, yes, I'll come and do it, rather than me being stuck here on my own. Today, we are going to talk about sugars and molasses, and our guest is Bron from QLF. So hello, Bron.
Hello.
Technical manager, is that the correct title?
Ruminant technical manager.
Ruminant technical manager. Sorry, I didn't get one. But before we get on to Bron and... the subject, just a couple of bits of housekeeping. As a Sarah's joined us today as guest host. Neil is currently overseas, so I hope he's enjoying himself while we're recording this. For those that follow the podcast, they may know I was going to enter a cake in the Gillingham Shaftesbury show. You may have seen the result on social media. I got a very highly commended, so unfortunately I didn't get a prize, but I got a certificate, so I can't argue with that, so it must be doing all right. For those that also remember a couple of episodes ago, I said for anyone that emails in, first five that emailed in, they're potentially a Tune the Cud podcast hat. There are still some of those available if anybody wants to contact us, no matter where you are in the world, we'll send them out to you. Contact us at podcast@tunethecud.com, remember no G. And finally, there is now a puppy in the household. He is quietly asleep, I believe, finally. But if we get any noise or interruptions, that's what it is. So apologies for that. So on to today's subject, sugars and molasses. Initially, we were going to talk about the rumen, but with Sarah joining us today and her subject being on soils a couple of months ago, that might work out well, because I know Bron is interested in soils.
Very much.
And the sugar role in soil, so I'm sure we'll talk about that at some point. Sounds but otherwise, good. Bron, apologies, you know I am terrible. I can never pronounce your surname, so I will let you pronounce your surname, and then, yeah, we'll take it from there.
Okay, well, I'm Bron Pilarit, and as you said, I'm from QLF. Thank you for having me.
But your surname's Swedish, is that?
My surname is Swedish, yes. Swedish. I'm married a Swede.
As we all look at the Swedish chef over there, but anyway, that's beside the point. Anyway, so Bron, before we go on to the subject, tell us about you and yourself. How did you get to where you are today?
I came into agriculture, slightly different journey perhaps than a lot of folks. I born onto a beef and arable farm, had previously been a dairy farm. Cows went, I don't know, probably about 3 or 4 years before I came along.
I'm just trying to think. Well, that'd be about time the golden handshake, wouldn't it? Early 80s?
It was 80.
80.
Yeah, I think, knowing my father's luck, it was probably just before.
Milk quotas came in, didn't they? When was that? 83, wasn't it?
I was going to say 84, but I could be wrong.
It was 83, 84, and then they had a golden handshake, didn't they? And got people out, and a few people did. Yeah.
So the herd went in 80, yeah. I grew up on mainly surrounded by beef animals, and the arable side of it actually at that point didn't interest me in the slightest. I got involved a little bit around the calves, but not a lot. Neither myself nor my sisters were actively encouraged into agriculture.
It's a man's job,
and we were all girls, sadly, but that's a sign of the times. Thankfully, it's all changed. In fact, your women in dairy, if that had been around back then, perhaps we'd have been encouraged to get more actively involved. We weren't even encouraged into young farmers. It was a sad life, really, wasn't it? But there we are.
You say that, let's be honest, if we go back to that period, you didn't really see women in agriculture.
You didn't.
Not certainly on farm.
Not regularly. It was, no. You know, it turned your head, didn't it? And even when I did end up joining the industry, I was still, you know, as a rep, which I'll come on to in a moment, I mean, I was still the odd one out by a long way, whereas it's not uncommon now.
Now it's very different.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was a trailblazer, you see.
So. Well, I mean, I know I've had discussions, but I mean, obviously now there are a lot of women farmers. I mean, our last guest was Catherine Pickford, yep, who won Farmers Weekly Dairy Farm of the Year, and there are a lot of good women farmers.
Absolutely.
Bloody good farmers, yes, actually.
Yeah.
most of them. And but also, look, I remember, like you were saying that, I remember the first woman vet turning up, and I'm having this discussion with one of the vets who's now retired himself, and it's like, oh my god, it's a woman vet. Is she going to be strong enough? Is she going to be this? This is large animals. Is she going? She's going to pinch everybody's husband. Is it this? Is it that? She did marry a local farmer, but she didn't pinch someone's husband. Whereas now, you go into most vet practices,
yeah,
it's more women. It's not, there isn't the men.
No, and there was. Thank goodness that, you know, I would say even, well, less than 10 years ago, I would say those sentiments were still very much there of looking over your shoulder. You go, oh gosh, the new rep's a girl, the new rep's a woman, but watch out. And, you know, it's pathetic, really, isn't it? And thankfully, we've moved beyond that. So, yes,
very, on the road in the 90s.
Very, very quickly, it has changed, thank goodness. But, my route to market, so to speak. I studied something completely different. I went down to Exeter University and studied archaeology and worked in field archaeology for a number of years, both in Ireland and over here.
Did we ever see you on Time King?
I was just thinking about that. I think I may have been in the background on one episode where they were filming at Hampton Court Palace. But I certainly...
We'll go find that episode.
Wouldn't have been interviewed. I might have been in the background. But I seem to remember we got a team shot with Tony Robinson in the front of it. But actually, he was the... He gave me my degree at Exeter because he was... he was Chancellor at the time. He's not any longer... but at the time, he handed me my degree, and nothing to do with the fact that it was an archaeology degree, just pure chance.
An ex-graduate of Exeter as well. I was presenting mine from Floella Benjamin from high school days.
Those are the stuff
I will have to remember.
She still is Chancellor, I believe. Yeah,
Dame Floella Benjamin. Yes. But yes, I certainly remember her on high school.
Yeah, definitely.
So, we're showing our age now. Yeah.
Where did I get to? So after the archaeology, the industry is very much based upon what's happening in housing and road building schemes. It's part of the planning process. It's not done for fun, as most folks assume that it is. So when the money runs out, the redundancy tends to come. So that coincided around the same time as I was actually already looking to apply for a chancing my luck, really, on a graduate training scheme at Countrywide Farmers, the late Countrywide Farmers. So I'd been graduated about 6 years by that point, so I shouldn't have had a hope, given that I think most grad schemes are year to 2 years post-graduation. But they took me on anyway. I spent, about 6 months to a year, something like that, shadowing folks within roles around retail, so the buyers, the managers, the stores, and then around, on the as they call it, direct sales side of the business as well, so the farm sales to you and me, and that's where my natural draw was. You can take the girl off the farm, you can't take the farm out of the girl. And actually, even though the dairy cows had gone before I even came along, it was dairying that was my main draw. Although, having said that, my recent growing interest in soil health and mixed farming, I'm becoming more of a beef girl, but a sort of a grassland grazed beef girl than I was previously. So I suppose, that's the joy of continuing education, isn't it? Your interests change and grow as you change and grow. So I left Countrywide. I didn't leave Countrywide. I went off to have my baby. I went on maternity leave. And whilst that was happening, Countrywide was purchased by Four Farmers. So I came back from maternity working for Four Farmers, which was odd because everybody else had gone to them all in one group and I was the little tag along me. So I suppose I didn't have the same introduction to the business that everybody else had and didn't settle, to be honest. So a part of company from them and have been with QLF for, I think, I was thinking about it previously, it's either 6 or 7 years. I think it's 7 years that I've been with QLF. Time flies.
When you're having fun.
And within that time, I came into, having come from the background I came from, having come from, dare I say it, a little brown nut company, I knew next to nothing about sugars. And it was all about, really, genuinely, it was all about selling compound feed blends and palletized products, because that's where, dare I say it, the money is. And so, yeah, when I came into QLF, I was clueless, completely clueless, as I think a lot of people are on sugar, be they either on the farm sales repping, even really good nutritionists often find that knowledge hasn't ever made it to them, because if you don't go out and find it, or somebody like me batters you around the head with it. I have battered you around the head with it. You're right. That knowledge just isn't out there, and I'm glad to. I think it is finally making its way a little bit more into the farming press than it used to be. But it's not sexy. Sugars aren't sexy.
And I hate to say it, but usually within those big companies, like you say, it's about where the margin.
Yes,
is.
It is.
The margin is the cake.
Yes.
And I've seen it on farm with a farm that was feeding 15 kilos of cake because and nothing outside, because that's better for your cows, said the rep from a well-known company. Mm. But it isn't. As you say, it's sugars. So, okay, sugars, take a step back.
Yep.
For me, you know, it took you a little while to batter me around the head, as you so
yes,
eloquently put it.
I did.
Bruises don't show anymore. Right?
No, I know. It's been a few years.
I've got the cricket bat back in case I need it.
But for me, molasses, I fed it at college, was just one of those things. But otherwise, for me, my real experience was not far north Queensland. We were up, basically an hour of us down on the coast was sugar country. We were, you know, sort of a couple of hours from Cairns, it's all just sugar country along the coast there. And so molasses was a cheap byproduct. And we fed it, and most people would be, what, when you first tell them to? It was conventional, swing over dairy, 15 a side. But instead of having an individual trough for each animal, we had one big stainless steel trough. So the whole length of the dairy, probably about a foot deep, then with dividing bars across the top. And then, so any grain was dropped onto the molasses. So they had ad lib, they had the grain, I don't know, 8 kilos a day max, I think it was. And then they had ad lib molasses they could eat as they want. The biggest thing that you occasionally forget to do is to turn that pump off after milking. You turn up in the morning, 4 in the morning, whatever time it was, and your dairy was covered in molasses because the pump had been going all night, and it was a little bit of a sticky mess that took quite a little bit of hosing to get off. So
something like swimming through treacle.
Yes, yes. So you can laugh. It, looking back at the time, you're like, oh. So, but the problem was the cows would eat. They would eat their grain, and then they'd enjoy the molasses. So they walk out the dairy and you'd put your hand on, I don't know, the race or the crush, and it'd be like, ugh, it's just covered with this horrible sticky mess. So when we built the rotary, one of the things was, do we want molasses? And I was just like, no, hate it, because it was just, ah. I know others that built rotary after us did want it. So they developed a system. I think they had an overhead tank. As the bale went round, it hit a switch, dollop of molasses, mm-hmm. and then the grain. I now know otherwise, that there are benefits to it. At the time, I thought it was just a cheap byproduct. It's just, and it was, you know, up there, it was cheap. It was.
And was this a popular way to feed it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of people up there, some just fed literally molasses and that was it. But for most, certainly North Queensland, yes, it was pretty much ad lib molasses because it was such a cheap product. And the sugar mills were, where was I nearest one? I think Babinda was like an hour down the coast to Innisfail and then probably half an hour up. So it was only an hour and a half away from the sugar mills. So it was a cheap product. And the flip side of that, when I was in Victoria, 2,000 miles, transporting molasses was bloody expensive.
Yeah.
So I've seen farms feed raw sugar. And people look at me when I say that, you know, I've seen farms with pallets of 25 kilo bags of raw sugar to put in their premix to ensure that they had the sugar.
Was it processed sugar? Or was it, you know, was it white sugar as we see it? Or was it literally just up cane?
I'd say it was processed, but it was like you get brown sugar. I think
non-refined.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah, but yeah. Still, the way that we would picture granular sugar rather than.
Yes. So, there I mean, we okay, are, yeah. We're talking. I'm getting old now, 20 years ago, so the memory might not quite be the same, but it was literally, I remember going, it was when, I think it was when we were looking at rotaries, so it probably would have been sort of 2000, sort of around then, before we built, we looked around Victoria, and there was this guy in the corner of his shed, had a pallet, it had 25 kilo bags, and in it was raw sugar.
Yep.
So what did he know that I don't know? Because I don't understand why you'd want to be feeding that sugar to dairy.
Well, I guess that's why we're here, isn't
all
it?
All will become clear.
Have you been practicing? So that was my experience of it. And I mean, obviously the sugar canes, the cane fields up there would be known for, well, most people think of sugar cane you burn. And I should say that certainly in my time there, I probably only ever saw fields burn once. Mm. They can still use it to control pest and disease. But for those of us that are old enough to remember, that's where the old Peugeot 406 adverts were filmed of the driving through the burning cane fields and all exploding to, what was it?
Take
My Breath Away, as we, you know, as they drove through it. So, yeah. Anyway, so that was my experience. Obviously, I've come back here, various roles that I got to where I am, met Bron, and Bron, as she said, got out of the cricket bat many times. Because I should
You will listen to me, Andrew.
Took a few times, but you will listen to me. But I should say one thing that didn't help, and you'd agree with this, Bron, is no ration program really utilises or shows the proper usage of sugar in there at all. As soon as you put molasses in a ration program, not just the one that I use, it will scream at you and say, too many rapidly fermentable carbs, your acid loading is too high.
Yep.
Woo, can't do this, you're going to upset the rumen. And that's, I guess, going to put people off. They don't have the experience, they don't have the trust, or whatever it happens to be, of going to do it. And I know now, with experience, and I suppose a little hand-holding from yourself to start with, I now know, put it in there, it's not a problem. In actual fact, it probably improves rumen
health. It will do.
Rather than affecting rumen health. And you will get benefits. I've seen the benefits on farm, which we can talk about in a minute, but... So that's where I sort of started my journey with sugars from. But why sugars then? Why? Because there's talk of five sugars and six sugars. What's the difference? Why do you want to feed molasses? Why is that adding something that isn't already there? Or where is it? Where do you want to start?
Okay, so six carbon sugars are really, if you think about anything which is a storage vessel for sugars, so it could be a blade of grass, which is relatively temporary storage. It could be a sugar beet, a bulb in the ground.
Yeah.
It could be a sugar cane. And obviously the beet and the cane are much longer term storage of sugar, but that basically they are a storage vessel for sugars produced through photosynthesis. Yeah. So going back to our school...
Any plant is photosynthesis.
Yeah. So going back to our school boys, girls lessons on photosynthesis. Yes, we do. Just for a moment. I won't go. Believe me, I don't do technical. Well, I shouldn't say that when I'm technical.
Yeah, you're
different sort of technical. I don't like over.
Should I be ringing your boss at this point?
I don't like overcomplicating things. We'll put it that way. You know, if you can't understand something simply, then you know, you've got to wonder who explained it to you. But basically, what we're doing is we are making the most of a biological process, which the rumen has evolved to make use of. So, you know, a cow out at grazing, there are times when, and I'm going to pass this back to you, Andrew, how much would you say that at certain times of the year, you know, you're going to see more fresh grass samples than I am? Yeah. Where are the sugars? Where are the sugars in the grass, and where are the sugars average within your diets?
You could quite easily have 10% plus in the grass, quite easily. I mean, I could pull up a couple of samples if we wanted to, but yeah, when it's the right time, spring, etc., etc., you could quite happily see 10% plus in sugars in the grass. You probably want it more than that before you ensile anyway.
Yep.
And that's certainly one of the trackers that Trow use on their, you know, silage tracker. But on the flip side, as you were saying, in a housed diet, typically, and you'd probably say the same because you see others as well, 2-3%.
Yep, that's about average.
And that's low. I mean, we should take a step back and say, on your silage sample, when you look at your sugars, those want to be as low as possible. And people get a little bit except always got a lot of sugar in. Well, usually those sugars are an indication that you've not necessarily had a good fermentation.
Mm.
You want those sugars used for fermentation, would you?
I would. I would agree to an extent. I think it depends on the dry matter of the grass. Because obviously a drier grass will take less acid to ferment than a wetter grass. So I would expect a drier grass to have higher residual sugars than a wetter grass.
I should be afraid. No, they don't want to be as high as you sometimes see.
No. No, no. I mean, at the end of the day, when we're in silage, when we're changing, chemically changing a crop from a fresh grass to an ensiled silage, we need that sugar to do a different role, and that is to ferment that crop and make it stable, which isn't the same role as biology and evolution intended when the cow comes along and munches down the grass that has photosynthesized to create a storage vessel of energy, which is being utilised by that rumen. So it's two different things. So when we're...
I suppose if you look at the natural cycle of a cow, if we weren't interfering, I guess she's probably going to... Ideally, she's going to calve in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of grass when she needs to produce, and it peaks for April, May time, probably when she wants to be at her highest yield.
Yep.
And then deteriorates as her lactation... deteriorate.
Exactly. And the grass quality, obviously, through the winter, goodness knows what this year will do with the Indian summer that we're potentially heading into. But, you know, the sugar content, as with everything else, the dry matter intake, availability, everything is going to drop off through the winter. So all we're doing through supplying sugar into the rumen through the housed period or the winter, but even the buffering period, is to replace what either has diminished through the weather and agronomically, or that we've taken away through ensiling in order to allow our cows to produce milk all year round.
It makes so much sense, doesn't it, that you're trying to put back the sugar into the diet that would naturally be there if they were grazing at that time of year.
So sugar is not... I know you were talking about it as a waste product, as cane molasses, and it is, don't get me wrong, it is a waste product. However, we're utilising it in a way to try and feed a cow in actually a really natural way. But we're not trying to do anything that the rumen hasn't evolved to deal with.
But up there, it really was, I guess, a waste product because you were at source. There was so much of it available. That's why, I mean, we were feeding ad lib, whereas here you wouldn't because of cost.
Basically, some folks will through lick feeders, but it's not common.
No, no. But in a dairy environment...
Environment's usually through the wagon.
And it's usually through cost. So my ration programme, while we're saying typical diets here are, what, 2%, 3%, my ration programme doesn't start screaming until sugar levels are above 10%. But
that's unusual, I'd say, because I've seen RSVCs on ration programmes screaming when you add maybe... a kilo of molasses, which would be potentially taking you to only maybe 4-5%.
I should say it screams at the sugar level.
Oh, the sugar levels. Sorry, not the acid loading levels. Misunderstood.
So just help me understand there. You're saying that trying to bring the ration up from sort of a 2-3%.
We need to be aiming a minimum of 6-8. That's where there's plenty of different papers that have been published over the years looking at slightly different things within the rumen and milking and even beef animals. And that seems to be the happy number, the happy place before things either economically it's not worthwhile, or you do potentially start to see a drop off in the improvements in digestibility when you start getting north of maybe 9-10%. And it's just, you know, economically, I'm not going to tell a lie, molasses isn't as cheap as Andrew's had it in the past, but it is a value for money product if it's fed sensibly. But it's not something, a bit like soy, it's not something you want to overfeed for fun. It's something to put in the diet strategically to do a job.
And there are definitely benefits to it, and I've seen 100% benefits on farm. And like you say, the ration programs don't usually account for it very well. So while it's saying my acid loading's too high, actually I think it's seen better acid or better rumen health. But also, I mean, I know, okay, one of the early ones, it took you a little bit to convince me, we fed the molasses And we did see an improvement in solids.
Yes.
And that is, from what you said to me, is what you'd usually expect.
And that's, again, down to the improvement in rumen health. All linked.
And we started feeding for another reason in that instance, trying to stop some sorting, which is obviously another benefit. But we did see a slight drop in milk, only slight, but when we actually did the financial figures, despite the slight drop in milk, but because we had those increase in solids, we were actually financially better off for feeding that molasses.
I'm surprised that you did see a drop in milk.
It was only, it was like 0.1, 0.2.
Yeah,
it was not a
wouldn't
huge
be a lot.
Amount at all. I can't remember, I mean, it's probably five, six years ago, maybe. Probably if I found it somewhere, I might still have the figures. But yeah, it was just ever so slightly.
Yeah.
But we saw the improved solids, and as you say, we saw improved health, because one of the issues there was we were seeing a lot of sorting.
Yep.
We were seeing when you looked at the milk fatty acids, we were seeing huge variation in milk ureas on individual cows, and all these things were happening. So we were adding it as much for a health benefit, and we saw the health benefit.
Yes,
but
good.
It showed that we were paying for it.
Yep.
It was certainly wiping its face, and I'd say actually a little bit more besides.
Yep.
So it's from my point of view, that worked, and I guess that was the first one that made me go, actually, I should listen to her.
I'm not just making it up.
You're saying it will likely impact butterfat levels.
Butterfats and milk proteins. So a lot of these studies obviously have been done in the States, where they sell on components. So everything matters to them in terms of solids.
And
so a lot of
buyers,
exactly so. again around here, particularly a lot of cheese buyers. So, but in the mainstay within the UK, when we're talking sugars, we tend to talk fats. But no, it will have a positive effect on fats and proteins, and it's all to do with the rebalance, really, of starch and sugar in the rumen. So we've got over the decades, I suppose, very dependent on producing milk and getting energy into cows through cereals, through starches, and not necessarily thought about the consequences of not replacing the sugars, particularly on these fully housed herds who aren't getting the sugars in the diet really at any point through the year. Not thinking about what we're missing through not replacing it. So what Andrew has found, and what a lot of folks who delve into the world of sugar within ruminant nutrition will find, is that if you can rebalance that starch and sugar content, you can actually push your overall starch and sugars higher. But if you've got a great enough amount of sugar within the rumen, because they perform differently in the rumen to starches, you don't see that pH drop. So we don't see that risk of SARA that you see.
Starches have got to break down to their sugars to be used.
Yeah,
anyway.
And that takes me back. You asked me what's the difference between 5 and 6 carbon sugars, and I never actually answered that question, but that takes me onto it nicely. So the syrups that we see out there, which would be sort of 5 carbons, they've already gone through a fermentation process. They are waste products from distilleries and things like that. They are not sugars, they're syrups. That's why the name syrup is in the name. And a lot of people will use one or the other. They're different things completely, and they will behave completely differently in the rumen. The 6 carbon sugars are the ones that we're talking about today, when you will see the positive improvements in rumen health, and those are the ones that haven't yet gone through a fermentation process. So it's all there for the rumen microbes to have a go at. And protozoa as well, who were a big fan of sugar, particularly when it comes to improving fiber digestibility. But I don't know which bit you want to discuss first in terms of the benefits that we can expect to see from sugar. But
I should point it out, really, we are feeding the rumen.
We're feeding the rumen.
You're feeding two things. You're feeding the rumen, then you're feeding the cow.
Yeah.
So your bypass stuff is effectively feeding the cow. But with the sugars, for one, and I guess that rapidly degradable protein, I'll try and say that is all about feeding those rumen bugs.
Yes.
And the more we can maximise them, the better we're going to have rumen function, digestibility, etc.
So again, it's going back to what you were talking about in your podcast, Sarah, about working with nature and with biology and not trying to constantly battle against it. And that's exactly what we're trying to do. And I think, you know, for folks who have both farmers and nutritionist consultants alike who bundle sugars and starches in the same pot. It's just look at that distinction between how you break down in your own mind about proteins. Do you bundle soya and palm kernel and distillers all as one? This is my protein pot. Or do you look at them and the role that they play within the rumen differently? Okay, we've got a slightly different thing going on there because you've got your different, you know, amino acid breakdowns, et cetera, et cetera. So it is different. But my point is, we can't keep going on looking at the two as one because they're not. They behave completely differently. Within the rumen, when we break down starch, we are really focusing on our propionic bugs within the rumen. They're proliferating, they're growing, you know, which is why if we end up feeding too much, we can then drop the pH of the rumen too much and run into into acidosis issues.
And when you look at it like that, you know, we feed starch for milk.
We feed starch for milk.
You mentioned it, you feed starch, you get propionic fermentation within the rumen, and propionic acid drives milk production.
Whereas with sugars, you do still get propionic fermentation, don't get me wrong. And actually, when you look at it in terms of, you know, graphically, you know, the data that's come out in these papers, which, by the way, Andrew has access to all. So if any listeners want to look at any of this data, just contact Andrew because I can pass the papers on. we can share any data that if anyone has any specific questions. But what we are seeing with sugars is a molar increase in production of butyric acid.
It gets a balance. So instead of being, it's never purely propionic, but you get the more butyric.
Which then
helps butterfat.
Yeah. Well, on that, that's one way. That's one way that it is helping. Yeah. I mean, obviously, when we think about fat production, we think about butyrate, but there's actually slightly, I think, more going on there than that in terms of the effect that that has on drawing acid out of the rumen and not allowing the rumen pH to keep descending down.
Start to about osmotic effect.
I'm not, because it's
that was always something I did struggle with.
Yeah, well, yes, I believe it's happening. But no, we don't need to go into detail on that now. We just need to understand the fact that it's happening. And that when we feed sugars, yes, they are very rapidly fermentable carbohydrates. There's no getting away from that. But it doesn't mean that they're behaving the same in the rumen as your rapidly fermentable starches, because they are fundamentally not. And if we start to look at them as two different pots and balance the two together, because don't get me wrong, you can't be replacing all starches with sugar. That's just ridiculous. But it's about managing the two together to improve rumen health. And we do start to see improvements in fibre digestibility. So one of the first things that my ears prick up, and you know, when I'm talking to reps for companies that we work with, etc., and they, you know, saying to me, "Oh, there's a lot of fiber in the muck." That's one real classic. Milk ureas are really high. Well, are we missing something really obvious here? you pop in some sugar into that diet and you say, "How's the muck looking?" "Oh, much better." "How are your milk ureas?" "Oh, they're a bit low." And they tell me what the figures are. Oh, that's fine. Because when you're feeding sugars, you expect your milk ureas
actually, sort of from an efficiency point of view,
you're utilising everything.
Carbon footprint.
Exactly.
Nutrition and exactly. everything else. Adding the sugars, is that going to help our carbon footprint?
Yeah,
that's obviously a buzzword.
I mean, the work's being done at the moment, so I don't have the information at the moment. The work's being done at the moment on the carbon footprint of the raw materials that go into molasses products. So you know, that will be hot off the press in a few months.
From an efficiency point of view, we're trying to get our system as efficient as possible.
It is helping that. Just said it's we always said it really. It's helping the rumen bugs, isn't it?
It's helping the rumen bugs, but also as I said, the protozoa. So obviously, protozoa tend to predate on the bacteria, but they get turned on, if that's the right word, by sugars. So that's one of the main reasons why you see an improvement in the efficiency of fibre digestibility, particularly. So, you know, traditionally, you know, back when Andrew said, "Oh, we fed molasses at college," traditionally, a lot of the pushback I get when I'm talking to folks is, oh, I only feed molasses if I've got a poor silage. Well, great, because it is going to help digest that poor silage, but it's actually going to help with any form of fibre. And, you know, the only potential caveat to that might be a situation where you've got multi-cut system where actually they're lacking in fibre and we need to be slowing the rumen down. In that situation, I would probably step back and say, I'd love to make my sale, but molasses is not the right product for you. Go and speak to, you know, grow some whole crop potentially and sort out your own situation, or, you know, get some fibre in that diet and slow everything down. But in most situations, molasses is going to improve the digestibility of that of the fibre within that rumen.
Usually, as you say, but then also, as well as improving the digestibility, improves palatability, which usually then increases intakes, and
yep.
usually then just snowballs, the greater the intakes, the greater production, yep. And, yep. and away it goes.
And, you know, you've got a question.
My little brain cells were sort of working there, and you were talking very much about house cows, but my brain was sort of thinking about it. King's ABC, a lot of... sort of butterfat drops in the spring and that kind of thing. So has molasses got a role to play in the sort of the fibre digestion as cows go out to grass? Or
I think that's a different story. I think that is more about the waxy coating you get on leaves in the very early spring.
It is, as Bron said, that probably is likely. One, they're probably not grazing down tight enough. They're just grazing the leaves, not the stalky fibrous bit. But also it can be the waxy cuticle that then is causing effectively an oil slick within the rumen. And once you get too much oil in the rumen, that will drop your butterfat.
So it looks... No, it looks like...
The sugar should be there, though. If you're talking early spring, the sugar should be there
naturally. Yeah, and that, again, has been a pushback before of folks saying, but, you know, when the sugar's high in the spring, my cows get acidosis. It's not the sugar. It's the waxy coating on the leaf that's making them loose, potentially, on that one.
Well, I've had one or two people this, I'm not going to say autumn, we're autumn now, but this summer, when we suddenly, after a dry June, suddenly got warmth in July and August, I've had one or two people say, I think my cows got acidosis, what are you feeding them? Grazed grass and a bit of, I don't know, was it hay or something? It's like, no, you basically got spring grass, suck it up, there's nothing we can do, it's not worth... doing you basically got what you'd expect to see in the spring.
Yep.
And effectively we had a double spring this year almost, didn't we? Because we've seen growth rates at like 100, which you'd never normally see outside April. The quality on the fresh samples I get, spring, we've effectively had a double spring this year in terms of grass.
Yep.
I guess, did you see, were people complaining about their butterfat drops again, sort of July, August?
Certainly, we do. We have seen that at King's Hay.
Makes
sense, thank you.
No, that's all right, that's why we want
that's
you
why
here.
I'm not a nutritionist.
No, I was just saying about the fibre digestibility side of it, and I'm going to say something potentially contentious now.
Ooh, go on,
but
I like this.
It's not contentious. There have actually been some published papers on it, but very few so far. Most folks go a bit sort of quiet when you start talking molasses around dry cows.
Yeah, I'm probably one again. You keep telling me myself.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in some situations, in a high grass silage situation, probably not a great idea. But for these situations now where we've got folks feeding north of 7 kilos of well-chopped straw, potentially even higher than that in some cases, if you can improve your fibre digestibility and if you can improve your increase the amount of butyrate production, of thinking back to, I don't know, have you done anything around calves, Sarah?
Yes.
So if you think back to your baby calf nutrition, when we're trying to develop those rumen papillae, we need butyrate in order to do that. Whereas if you've got plenty of butyrate in the rumen in that dry period, when the cow's having her rest and her rejuvenation, and that's the period when, if there is any, you know, potential SARA damage from the previous lactation, she's got a chance to fix everything. She's got a chance to, you know, have a go at extending those papillae a bit. You're giving her everything she needs.
But it's that... potassium.
It's the potassium issue,
isn't it?
It's the decap thing. But if you, I mean, I'm I'm personally a follower of the Goldilocks system. Yes. So, you know, for me, it's good old Gordy. It's all about intake. It's all about room and fill. And if you've got enough room and fill, enough intake, and a low enough energy diet through your high straw, that when she calves in and moves into hopefully eating exactly the same amount of dry matter, if you've got that dry period right, as she goes into her fresh period, then metabolic problems become much less of an issue.
I suppose also one of my cats, I've never found it too much of a problem with somebody where we've fed 6 kilos easily of straw and probably sort of 14 kilos plus dry matter intake. I didn't feel I needed to feed more than what we were, because most people go 14 kilos. And it's like, yeah. Because I guess most people sort of go, 12 for a transition cow. We're quite happily feeding 14 with 6 kilos plus of straw. Didn't feel we had the need. And I suppose it's because of that potassium. And I've got one or two other people, obviously, I talk to, and they just say to me, no, just don't go there.
Yeah, I said, it would be contentious.
just don't go, because I remember seeing an article, was it British Dairy or something, a couple of years ago, someone successfully saying that they were feeding molasses in their transition period. Mm. I said to this one person, I said, what do you think? He said, no, just don't go there. So, I mean, would you do it but balance it with the decab, or would you just say it's not an issue? I do it.
Yeah. And, you know, at times of the year when there is a, perhaps we're running out of maize, something like that, a little bit more reliant on the grass, then you do have to just keep an eye on where your decab is.
Yeah.
But I've never been a full decabber. I think you either are or you're not.
Partial with some MAC chloride.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's not so much partial, it's just keeping it low. Keeping it sensible.
Yeah.
But for me, it's more about getting that room and fill. But as I said, if you're achieving that room and fill already and you're not feeling the need for it, then, you know, as with a lot of things in transition, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. No. But I just thought I'd put it out there as an opportunity to try and get those intakes into some of these cows where we really are challenging them to eat a lot.
Draw that cricket bat out as we're talking.
I have, I believe, sent you a paper relatively recently, Andrew. Yeah.
but are you right, though? That argument on the butyrate is right, because that is the time to, as you say, redevelop those papillae.
Yeah.
And so I can see what you're saying is an advantage to doing it. I guess it's like everything, until you've tried it, a bit like it was with me with molasses to start with, and going, oh, my acid loading's doing this and whatever. Until you tried it, you're always a little bit wary of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's any adventurous farmers that are listening to us today, how would you recommend they go about perhaps adding molasses to their dry cow diet?
So I would say the same. Oh, Andrew's got his hand up.
No, I'm trying to say, tell him to ring me.
Oh, yeah. Rig Andrew, definitely. But no, I would say just the same principle as with a milking cow. Aim for around 6%, probably not up to the 8, but around that 6% mark of your overall dry matter intake as sugar, and you will see the improvements in the fibre digestibility. And if you are trying to run a full decab, then no, it's probably not the right change for you. But I don't think there are many folks in this country. I'm probably going to get bombarded with messages via you now. Yes, we are. But I think a lot of folks have sort of moved away because our forages vary so much. It's such a difficult thing to get right, to do a full balanced decab all the time. So it's just another potential option to get out there, that sugar around the dry period does not have to be scary.
No.
It's about changing perceptions.
It is, definitely. Well, it's like everything is. That's why we do this, isn't it? It's to try and inform people about maybe something they don't think about, or it's just to make people think. And if they then go, oh, actually, I can do something different and I can do it better, and if I am going to see these benefits, it's worth it, then great. If not, hey, have a listen and enjoy yourselves.
Yeah.
Take it from there. But I mean, as you say, but sugars around the world, though, are probably treated a little bit differently than over here, aren't they, in terms of how people think they should and shouldn't use them?
And I think that's to do with our going back to you know, the conversation we were having about my background and coming from, you know, Countrywide, Little Brown Nut Company. We have a very merchanted, if that's a word, I think I've just made up a new word, industry within the UK. Whereas there's other parts of the world that folks like you, independent nutritionists, are the norm.
Yeah.
And you would source your feed from the feed mills, but the feed mills wouldn't necessarily have reps going out there selling their product direct to farm. And I think that's one of the major differences with the UK. And I think that affects, you know, probably across the board on feed, but also potentially sort of agronomy as well. You know, we do things a bit differently over here, don't we? And I think that's part of the reason why certain things get airtime and certain things don't.
And as you say, let's be blunt about it. If you work for one of those companies, where's your biggest margin?
And it's understandable, isn't it? They've got mills to fill.
Yeah.
Of course they have. It's totally understandable why that's where they put their emphasis. That's their business model. I mean, I'm not trying to in any way take away from what these mill, you know, these compound companies are doing. Apart from perhaps open your eyes and your ears to some of the other options that are available to you. On top of that, because rebalancing, as they're going back to that rebalancing of starch and sugar, it doesn't have to take away necessarily, might slightly reduce, but doesn't have to solely take away anything that anyone's doing on farm. It's just rebalancing that approach and trying to think a little bit more like, well, what has this rumen actually evolved to digest? And what am I putting into it?
So I know obviously QLF, you're very molasses orientated, but are there other sources of sugar that farmers could consider?
Potentially, yes. Potentially, there'd be biscuit waste, which at times are cost effective and at times are not. But just bear in mind, there's also starch coming in through that.
Usually, the sort of best products I probably see, other than obviously molasses, the moist blends, as you say, which have the biscuit waste or have the waste in them, or waste, well, perceived waste feed in them. And they're usually the next best option, I would argue, for sugars, and therefore drives palatability, therefore drives intakes, etc., etc.
What they don't
have some of the benefits of, like, some of the sorting.
Exactly, that's what I was going to say. With Andrew saying on that one farm that he used an example previously, and he said that sorting was one of the things that we fixed, and obviously, you know, that wouldn't have the same effect on sorting.
It would help. Because again, it's that moist blend. So again, it's, I don't know, what do you call it? Making it sticky, for want of a better word. It's driving the palatability. So it does help, but probably not to the same extent. And I know I've got one farm, we were feeding moist blend, and then we're now feeding molasses on top as well. And we've definitely seen a benefit from doing that. But again, we're aiming for that. The sugars were at that point, I don't know, let's say 4%, and we've now balanced it so it is around that 6%, and we've seen the benefits of doing that. So again, it's like everything, it's ensuring it's right. It's like a completely different subject, but protected rates. There are so many out there and they're not all the same, and people need to be aware of that, because some have different properties, none are bad, but it's ensuring that diet is correctly balanced, because if it's not, I have seen with one particular protective rate, it caused butterfat issues. But that was simply because the oil levels in the diet, because of other products they were using, had got too high and it caused it. So it's just knowing.
Understanding the sugars and the sugars.
Yeah, it's understanding the balance of the whole diet.
Yeah.
It's not just about putting this magic product in, it's going to solve
definitely
it.
Definitely not.
It's about ensuring it is correctly balanced.
100%.
Sugar, starch, protein, whatever it happens to be, it's got to be correctly balanced.
And that made me, we were in mid-flow, so I didn't mention it before, but when you were talking about with, you know, back in Australia with the molasses and grain, this whatever it was that they were putting, was it cake? I don't know.
It was grain.
It was grain.
We had a roller mill. What was it? Mainly wheat.
Okay.
Well, no, mainly wheat, corn, I think it was. And then obviously we added bits to it like cottonseed meal as our protein.
Yeah, which wouldn't be the most palatable of things. So yeah, then that's what I was thinking. You know, in that scenario, you know, folks were probably using it as a means to mask bad flavours as well.
Probably, yeah. Because that was it. Our main protein source was cottonseed meal.
Yeah.
You know, rape and soya were just too expensive up in North Queensland.
Yeah.
And obviously cottonseed was around and about.
Yeah.
So if our little brown nut company is telling us that there's molasses in our cake, is that enough molasses?
No, it's a minute amount. If you look at the
most formulations on cakes are somewhere between 5 to 7% for molasses. And is there a binding agent?
It's a binding agent, yeah.
And it's not enough sugars for the purpose of balancing the diet.
Yeah. The thing, if you look at a ticket, obviously they're in descending order, and the molasses and the fats and oils and things like that sit right at the end, because they're literally there in order to make that nut a nut, literally bind it together and make it hard. That's what the fats and oils and the sugars are doing.
I might get slapped for this from someone, but if you sit again, we just said molasses is at 5 to 7%, depending on who you are. If you see something like soya under that, it's usually there literally just to go on the ticket and make it look a little bit better. It's not there enough to actually make a difference.
Which again is the point back to, it's the whole diet and balancing the whole diet that matters, not just putting something in for the fun of it. Because the same, you know, I'd say the same with molasses, and I do regularly, you know, if somebody rings up wanting a price or whatever, and I'm, you know, going into the discussion of what they're feeding, why they're feeding, and how much they're feeding, and, you know, trickling in a half kilo, I'm pretty much say either feed it properly or save you money, because it's just not worth it. Because there's no way at half a kilo, even a kilo in a lot of cases of molasses, that they're going to be getting anywhere near that 6% mark.
And right. If you're a kilo and a half to 2 kilos,
yeah, and if you're trickling around under that, then you don't start to see these improvements in digestibility and the improvements in butterfat and rumen health, and it literally is money down the drain. Do not waste your money buying molasses if you have no intention to feed it properly.
There's no point going from a 2 to a 4% diet. You've got to go from a 2 to 6% diet in terms of sugar levels. So to wrap up a little bit on the rumen, mm-hmm. So we can briefly talk about soils. The benefits of it, we're saying they are needed for good optimal rumen function,
mm-hmm.
to ensure we've got the right sugars, so the 6 ring sugars rather than the 5 ring sugars.
Yeah, so basically within this context, cane or beet, rather than a syrup.
Balancing starches and sugars. It'll increase fibre digestion. It'll help optimise rumen pH. Usually shows higher milk quality.
Yep.
Can occasionally show more milk, but usually
it's quality. Yeah.
Will increase palatability and also reduce sorting. Were there any other sort of major points you would add on that?
For me, most of those, apart from the sorting side of it, clearly, which is more about physical, but most of the other points that you've made could all be put under the same umbrella of rumen health. So, yeah, all the rest of all the other benefits, all the commonly known benefits of sugar sit under the umbrella of we're improving rumen health.
And if you improve rumen health, you improve cow health.
Mm.
And that's what it's about. But then moving briefly on to soils, as I've got both of you in the room and you both have an interest in this subject, I'm not going to leave you. Sarah, you obviously spoke to us about soils and their role in carbon sequestration. See, I can still say it right.
You can still.
He's not even got it written down. I'm impressed, Andrew.
I know, I have. Since we saw you, I have to, and I'm talking about it. People go, what? Carbon sequestration. You've obviously got that, but Bron, I know you've got an increasing interest in soil health and the role sugars play in that. So explain that a little bit more.
Okay. Well, taking back to the beginning of this podcast when I was explaining about, why we feed molasses, fundamentals of photosynthesis, the plant, whatever that plant may be, a proportion of the sugars that plant creates, they actually send south. They send down into their roots rather than store it in their leaves. And they ain't doing that for fun. It's an expensive process, actually, photosynthesis. The plant is everything biology does, it does for a reason. And the reason that this is happening is basically to produce a sticky substance called root extradates. And that's not completely sugar. There will be some you know, amino acids and bits and bobs in there as well. But it's basically, it's a bug feed.
So all the just little bacteria like, are all heading towards
just
that
like route. When I'm feeding a rumen, I'm putting molasses in the rumen as a bug feed.
So are you very simply, sorry, that was me moving the chair, are you very simply saying that soils are effectively a rumen?
They are so similar, it is unreal. I mean, clearly there are differences, the major one being one's aerobic, one's anaerobic. But the, you know, we have bacteria, we have protozoa, we have fungi.
We have biological cycles. We have.
Exactly. And we have, for me, the biggest, this was my ping moment that got me excited, was realising and understanding the symbiosis between the plant and the bacteria. Because the plant aren't feeding the bacteria just for fun, to feed the bacteria. They're doing it so that the bacteria make available NPK, minerals, everything locked up in the soil. So you put your FYM out there, it's not actually available.
It's not readily available.
It's not available. It has to be made available by these bacteria. So we need an active group of bacteria down there in order to feed the plant, which will then feed the cow, which will then muck, which will then feed the ground. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful cycle.
And that fits in a bit, I suppose, with the podcast we did with Andrew Stillwell and talking about sulfur. He, you know, that is, he said, if you are relying purely on FYM at the beginning of the season, it's not there because it has not been, I can't remember what it needs to be turned into now, but it's not been turned into the appropriate source to be used, and away you go. So it's the same story.
It's the same. Basically. Because it's all about biochemistry. And this is, for me, where, you know, I can't remember whether I said when I was talking about, you know, my bio bit at the back and about the, you know, my background on the beef and arable farm, and I had zero interest in arable. And when I came to QLF and we had an arable-based product, our Boost, and I had zero interest in talking about it. And it's not until relatively recently, the last 2 or 3 years, when I've made that click moment of realising that I am fundamentally feeding bacteria. It doesn't matter whether I'm feeding bacteria in a cow or feeding bacteria in the soil, but I am enabling farmers to harvest the sun to produce energy, to produce food. I feel like I'm repeating here.
So basically it's turning that sun into milk or meat, whatever we're doing.
So anybody who's listened to Sarah's podcast already will realise that I've just basically paraphrased her, but it's true.
Thank you,
this
that's
is
flattering.
I should, on the flip side of that, say I have been to some MGA, so Maize Growers Association trials, like up at Lackham's, the one I've been to, and I know Boost, as we're mentioning, the product has been trialled up there.
It has.
And you have maize with Boost, without Boost. You can see the difference.
Yeah. So Boost is basically, we've recreated root extradate, basically, is what we're doing. So yes, all plants send root extradates down south. However, there are a lot of environmental and, more to the point, chemical elements that mean that some plants don't produce as much as they could. And the soil, either way, giving it a bit of a kickstart, you know, a glug of Lucozade before your marathon, basically, around the root zone, just allows that the rooting under the soil to speed up and become more complex. So the more little hairs you've got on your roots, the more surface area. Exactly the same as the rumen. The more papillae we've got, the more surface area. It's the same story. And that's
the more carbon we can sequester as well.
Exactly. And that's what makes me so excited about soil health, because the links to my, I don't think I even mentioned the fact that, I went to university in Exeter, but since then I've been to Harper Adams and I got myself my master's in ruminant nutrition. I didn't even mention that part. But so my history, my background, my interest is ruminant nutrition. But actually, they're so similar. And it is going to be the future. We've got to start seeing our farming cycles more cyclically in order to keep ourselves relevant. Okay, we'll always be relevant. We're producing food. But we don't always need to be picked on, shall I say, by the general population. We can become part of the positive
solution.
Story. And it's actually within our grasp. We just need to change our mindsets.
And actually, it's as Kingshay, we're very much healthy soils, healthy forage, healthy livestock,
yeah.
which actually goes in with healthy profit, but also in with sustainability.
Yep.
It's all tied up together. I mean, Neil, I think that's what's really interesting.
Neil and I have said this often enough, probably on other podcasts, the buzzword at the moment is sustainability. But 9 times out of 10, that can be swapped for efficiency. All you're doing is, and I know we all get fed up being told to be more efficient, and you know we have over the years, but it is ensuring that everything is done. It is cycle. It is make sure your soils are right. If your soils are right, you're going to get good forages. If you're going to get good forages, you're going to get, it's going to be easier to feed those cows.
Yep.
I mean, I know I recently had to give a talk last week, and that's what it came down to is, I struggled with what to say. I know I spoke to you about it, didn't I? What to say, because really the message was quality forages. If you've got quality forages, you can have high intakes of them, and therefore you don't need to supplement.
Yep.
You don't need that. And I, you know, have that. I still come back to example, you know, someone on a farm, once their advisor was getting excited because they were feeding 12.5 kilos dry matter intake of forages. Whoopee-doo. I remember looking personalised at the time, and we both said, you know, I've got a client last year, we were nearly hitting 17 kilos. And these were 650 kilo, 9,500 Holstein cows, good fat and protein. But the forages, if anything, we're struggling to make enough forage because we're feeding so much. If we were to only be feeding 12.5, we'd have loads.
Mm.
But the problem
is, the feed bill would be massive.
And his comment was, it does cost to grow quality forage. It does. But does it cost you that much more than to grow bad forage?
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah. And a lot of it's down to management, isn't
yeah.
it? You know, it's not so much of it is actually down to what's happening in the field. Mm. It's all of those other management impacts along the way from field to loss in the trough.
I can't remember the exact figure, but the classic example, if you look at, I redid it the other day for 35p, if you look at the recommended grass list, the difference in energy available between the highest on the recommended list, the lowest on the recommended list, and this is recommended list, this isn't off the recommended list, this is on the recommended list, is the equivalent of 1,100 pounds worth of extra milk because of the extra energy produced by that higher quality grass. That's 1,100 pounds per hectare. And yet people will argue over paying that 40 or 50 pounds extra per hectare in the grass seed.
Mm.
No, I'm not paying that extra £10 an acre or whatever on the grass seed or whatever it happens to be because, oh no, it's £10. But there's your benefit.
Mm.
The extra energy produced is saying we should do that. And I mean, I know before we start the podcast, we're doing, most of this regen is really going back to our grandfathers or great-grandfathers' ways of farming. Theirs was based on generations of experience, which we put aside for chemicals, for fertilizer. I'm not saying they don't have a place, but it's fine. It's having that balance of where they are in that place. But now we've got the science to back a lot more of this up. They didn't necessarily know why that was the right thing to do, but it was the right thing to do because experience had told them the right thing to do. And it all got shoved out the window because science had overwritten it.
Yeah, yeah.
It was actually just working with nature and working with what they'd got. And I think that we've tried to look at it maybe too closely and actually come away from working with the biological systems that haven't changed.
We've tried to enforce our stamp on it.
Totally. That's what it is.
I guess I particularly at the moment don't think a lot of, I personally am against, and this is my personal opinion, these methane suppressors.
I agree. So am I.
Because there's even a report come out, isn't there, somewhere that said that we know they work in the short term, but we don't know what the long term effects are going to be. Well, this cow's evolved for a reason to be where it is. I think if there is a way to do it, it's the genetic route, which one of the genetic companies have now found. It will take longer, but it can be done. But I just think forcing this cow to eat something to suddenly suppress methane, when there are bigger suspects of methane pollution, I think is wrong, that you're fighting against millions of years of evolution.
Well, we have to remember that ruminants and grasses evolved together.
Yeah, 100%. Along with the bacteria we're just talking about that comes out the back end and is needed in the soil.
And more often than not, they're on grounds that can't be used to grow wheat or can't be used to grow barley or whatever it happens to be feed us. It's on ground that needs a ruminant to make use of the grass to then give us milk or meat.
Yeah. And we need to make sure whatever we're putting in the rumen, particularly if it's synthetic, that we understand completely what's going to happen. And there's not a chance we can do that because we don't yet fully understand all of the different fungi, protozoa, bacteria, everything going on.
What is the percentage they know are in there?
Oh, I don't even know the answer to that.
It's not
a lot. No. It's more we don't understand than that we do. So if you start trying to suppress your methane producing bacteria in the rumen, what else are would those bacteria also have done which would have been positive for the cow that we've taken away?
Exactly,
and it's dangerous territory.
I think it came out of the southern hemisphere, I may be wrong, but I know that's exactly what this thing said. In 6 months, whatever they did on trial, they said we know it reduces the methane.
Yeah.
But we just don't know what the long term effects of that are. What, as you say, what are you suppressing that is beneficial because you're trying to methane suddenly the dirty word? Well, fine, go and talk to airlines or whatever else then, because they're a bigger polluter than we are.
Well, we know the best way to suppress methane is to feed higher levels of cereals, but then you get the counter argument that we should be feeding lower levels of cereals and because those are available for human consumption, and higher levels of forage because they're not.
Or we go back to the brown nut company you mentioned. There was one a couple of years ago who said you shouldn't be feeding any more than this level of forage in your diet because it will increase your methane production.
Wow.
And I read that thinking, we know what you're selling, don't we?
We're so cynical.
That is very cynical.
I know. Oh, well, but not to worry. Right.
The joys of being independent, huh?
Well, it does allow me to...
you can say what you think.
I'm not a corporate person. Honest, I could never be that corporate person. And I've had to bite my tongue in the past because I disagree with people. And sometimes you just got to do it.
I think if you're polite in your disagreement, you can always... As I said, it's your opinion, as long as you make that clear. This is not the opinion of the company I represent. It's my opinion and this is what I think. But you've got to have the knowledge to back it up.
That's why you're here. You're
here. Oh, but now we've shared that knowledge with everybody else as well. I now understand about sugar.
Good. Go forth and...
or understand more than I did before I started.
Go forth and evangelise.
So on that note, it's probably time we wrap this up, looking at the time we've recorded. So any last words of wisdom from you, Bron?
I think we've covered everything which is relevant, really, which is that we are making use of the energy from the sun in order to either produce a healthy rumen or produce healthy soils.
Sarah?
Amen to that. What else can we say?
That's fair enough. So on that note, I'd like to thank Bron for her time today and for her expertise.
Thank you for having me.
The knowledge she shared. And Sarah for joining us today as our guest host. I hope you've enjoyed yourself.
I've thoroughly enjoyed myself. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Good, good. You come back again if we need you to?
If you need me to.
That sounds good to me. We can't be too bad then. So on that note, we summed up the rumen earlier. We pretty much talked about soils, effectively some of the same benefits from that. As I'd like to say, like usual, follow us on Twitter at Chewing the Cud Pod. We are on Facebook and LinkedIn, just under Chewing the Cud Limited, if anyone wants to follow us on there. If you have any questions for myself or for Bron, more than happy to pass them on. Please email us at podcast@chewingthecud.com. Or as I say, there's still a couple of those hats available if anybody wants them. Say, just email us at podcast@chewingthecud.com. Remember, no G. Otherwise, I'd like to thank you both very much for your time today. And, thank you. And it's a goodbye from me.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now for the really boring bit, I'm afraid, the legal disclaimer. The information provided during this podcast has been prepared for general information purposes only and does not constitute advice. The information must not be relied upon for any purpose, and no representation or warranty is given to its accuracy, completeness, or otherwise. Any reference to other organisations, businesses, or products during the podcast are not endorsements or recommendations of Chewing the Cud Limited. The views of Andrew Jones are personal and may not be the views of Chewing the Cud Limited, and the views of Sarah Bolt are personal and may not be the views of Kingshay Farming and Conservation Limited and any affiliated companies. For more information on the podcast, articles, and details of services offered by Chewing the Cud Limited, visit www.chewingthecud.com. Thank you and goodbye.